Hello, and welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Pat Livingston.
And I'm Chris Sinclair.
And I am absolutely thrilled to be your guide today as we plunge into a really fascinating stack of sources from Bloomberg for Monday, August 11th, 2025.
Yeah, it's great to be here. And it really does promise to be, well, quite an illuminating session, I think. We've got a rich tapestry of information in front of us today,
We really do.
covering everything from global markets to the pretty nuanced impact of trade policy, and even some surprising cultural currents that seem to reflect deeper shifts happening in society.
Our mission, as always, is to unpack the most important nuggets of knowledge and insight from all this material. Think of it as your essential shortcut to being truly well-informed.
Exactly, with maybe some surprising facts thrown in.
And just enough humor, hopefully, to keep you hooked. Today, we're navigating just an incredible array of headlines. We've got the ripple effects of international tariffs, the shifting sands of global politics.
Unexpected movements in crypto, which are always interesting.
Always. And, the quiet struggles happening in private credit, which actually could have some really widespread implications. So, yeah, let's unpack this. There's a lot to dig into.
Definitely. Where should we start?
All right, let's kick things off with something that might literally be hitting your wallet directly. I'm talking about the pervasive reach of tariffs and the shifting dynamics of global trade.
Right.
We have a crucial report here from Goldman Sachs Group, Inc., and it really spells out how President Trump's tariffs are impacting U.S. consumers. It feels like a direct economic ripple effect we should all probably be aware of.
Yeah, and what's truly fascinating here, or maybe concerning, is the projected shift in who ultimately bears the cost, you know?
Right.
Goldman's economists, including Jan Hatzius, their chief economist, they highlight that initially when these tariffs first hit, U.S. companies, well, they largely absorbed the costs.
Okay, so they took the hit on their margins.
Pretty much took the hit to their profit margins, maybe hoping to, keep prices competitive, hold on to market share. But as we've seen before with these kinds of economic pressures, that's just not sustainable long term.
Right, something's got to give eventually.
Exactly. And the report clearly forecasts a significant shift. It seems almost inevitable, really. The burden is increasingly moving from those corporate balance sheets directly onto, well, us, the consumers.
So it starts with businesses trying to cushion the blow, but ultimately it just flows right down to us, the everyday buyers. And the data from Goldman, it's pretty stark, isn't it?
It is. Through June of this year, consumers had already absorbed an estimated, what was it, 22% of the tariff costs?
22%. But here's the kicker. If these most recent tariffs follow the patterns we've seen from previous trade actions over the past few years, that share is projected to rise dramatically, all the way up to a whopping 67%.
67%. Wow.
That's a massive jump. It means the majority of the cost is coming straight out of our pockets.
And this isn't just, some abstract number or a theoretical economic model. This shift has direct, tangible implications for inflation, something we all feel.
Definitely.
The core personal consumer expenditure index, the PCE index, which for our listeners, that's basically the Fed's preferred inflation measure, right?
Right, it strips out the volatile stuff like food and energy.
Exactly. Gives a clear picture of the underlying trend. Well, that index is projected to hit 3.2% year on year by December.
3.2%.
Now, if you take out the estimated effects of these tariffs, that rate would be significantly lower, closer to 2.4%.
Okay, quite a difference.
Yeah, and for context, it was at 2.8% in June. So this clearly indicates that tariffs aren't just some external factor, they are directly fueling inflationary pressure right here in the domestic economy.
Okay, that immediately makes me think about the Fed. This data must be complicating their policy decisions immensely.
Right, absolutely.
Because the Treasury market is already betting heavily on interest rate cuts. Traders are pricing in, what, over an 80% chance of a September cut?
Yeah, the odds are high.
But if tariffs are systematically pushing inflation up, that clouds the whole prospect for further easing. It really puts the Fed in a serious bind, doesn't it?
It does. They're forced to balance growth against price stability in, well, a very challenging environment.
So, is there a consensus on whether tariffs are truly inflationary in the way the Fed should worry about?
Well, that's where the debate gets nuanced. Goldman's analysis firmly supports the view that they are inflationary.
Okay.
Their reasoning is that businesses don't just hike all their prices at once, like a single shock.
Right. It's usually more gradual.
Exactly. They implement staggered price increases, passing on the costs over time. And this creates an ongoing cumulative increase in the general price level, which is exactly the kind of persistent inflationary pressure the Fed tries to manage with its policy tools.
Okay. That makes sense. But I've heard other viewpoints, like from economists like Orrin Kass. He argues tariffs are more of a one-time change in prices. Like, okay, this imported thing costs more now, but it's not ongoing inflation.
That's an excellent point, and it highlights the ongoing debate. Kass's argument is that if a policy makes a singular one-time change in specific prices, it shouldn't really be classified as inflation in that cyclical sense that monetary policy addresses.
Right.
However, Goldman's analysis, the one we're digging into, it provides a counterargument based on observing actual business behavior. They found companies consistently held back from immediate, all-at-once price hikes.
Ah, okay.
Instead, they've been doing those gradual, cumulative adjustments over months, sometimes even years. So this indicates it's not just an initial shock, it's a continuing, slow, upward push on prices as supply chains and demand adapt.
So while Kass's theoretical point might have some weight,
right,
Goldman's empirical data suggests a more persistent effect that the Fed probably can't just ignore.
Precisely. They really can't ignore it.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? Well, it means these tariffs directly impact your purchasing power. Tangibly.
Yeah.
Things cost more. Everything from groceries to electronics could get more expensive, and not just once, but gradually over time. And that makes the Fed's next moves absolutely critical for your personal finances.
It's a clear link. Trade policy to your daily economic reality.
Whether you realize it or not, really. Okay, so moving from that direct consumer hit, let's look at how corporations are adapting, how they're maneuvering in this tariff-laden world.
Yeah, it's a fascinating high-stakes game. Negotiation, strategic adaptation. We have some really prime examples here.
First up, the story of Apple's high-stakes exemption.
Ah, yes. This is almost a textbook case, isn't it? How corporate giants can navigate, maybe even influence policy in their favor.
So Apple CEO Tim Cook visits the White House.
Right. And reportedly gets a full exemption from new 100% tariffs on imported microchips, specifically for Apple.
Which for Apple, that's huge. Billions, potentially.
Immense. For a company so reliant on global supply chains for components, it's a massive win.
And the official reason given was Apple's commitment to a $100 billion U.S. investment. But, and there's always a but.
Always a but.
The source points out this was actually, well, a modest expansion of plans they'd already announced. Not some huge new thing spurred by the tariff threat.
Exactly. Which raises some uncomfortable questions, doesn't it? About the objective criteria for these exemptions. How much might the president's preferences, maybe even whims, be influencing tax and trade policy?
Right. The Bloomberg opinion piece we looked at highlighted this kind of thing can result in what are essentially propaganda wins for the White House.
Yeah, that was the term used.
It implies a system where maybe corporate titans provide favorable PR or strategic announcements in exchange for specific beneficial treatment.
And that approach, as this source points out, could potentially undermine America's long-term economic dynamism, its openness to entrepreneurs.
How so?
Well, because new startups, they don't have this kind of direct access, right? They can't just walk into the Oval Office and lobby for a tariff exemption.
It's a stark contrast to how Apple itself started, isn't it? In a garage, using off-the-shelf parts?
Absolutely. The idea that a company's success could now hinge partly on pleasing a president rather than just making great products.
Well, it's a concerning shift from traditional free market ideas.
It really is. In a functional market, executives shouldn't have to worry about tax policy swinging based on who likes or dislikes them.
Ideally, no. But the evidence suggests that maybe in the current environment, they very much do.
Yeah.
Which creates a really uneven playing field.
Okay, now let's look at another really unusual arrangement. This involves two huge AI chip makers, NVIDIA and AMD.
Ah, the revenue sharing deal. Yeah, this one is quite something.
They've agreed to pay 15% of their revenues from Chinese AI chip sales directly to the U.S. government, just to get export licenses.
15%? That's not just a significant chunk of change. It's a completely novel approach to trade control.
Just think about the financial impact on NVIDIA alone. In the last fiscal quarter, they raked in $4.6 billion from their special H20 chips for AI.
$4.6 billion.
Plus, they had another $2.5 billion worth of chips stuck unshipped due to prior restrictions.
Right. So if sales get back to previous levels under this new deal, the U.S. government could net roughly $1 billion a quarter just from NVIDIA's China sales.
It's staggering. This isn't just unusual, like the source says. It's kind of unprecedented. A new way to manage trade restrictions and generate direct government revenue from high-tech exports.
Unusual feels like an understatement.
Mm.
The sources say this arrangement is unnerving both U.S. companies, who have to fork over a big slice of revenue.
Understandable.
And Beijing, who sees it as an aggressive form of economic control. China's even accused the H20 chips of having back doors.
Which might be a negotiation tactic, showing they're not desperate for U.S. chips, but still, it adds another layer of mistrust and complexity.
It's such a delicate high-stakes dance, isn't it? Technology, trade, national security, the lines are just getting blurrier and blurrier.
It really is the financialization of export controls, in a way, instead of a hard ban, which could really hurt U.S. companies.
Right.
They impose a direct tax. It allows a constrained flow of tech, but the U.S. government gets a direct payment. It's, well, creative, maybe. Highly controversial, definitely. A new way to manage geopolitical tech competition.
Allowing the U.S. to benefit economically while still trying to slow China's tech progress. Wow. Okay, then we have Maersk, the global shipping giant.
Ah, yes. The surprising rally.
Exactly. Despite being heavily shorted by big names like Marshall Wace, their stock is up about 50% since early April, right when the latest tariffs were announced.
And they raised their 2025 forecast.
Astonishing. How does a massive shipping company rally during what everyone calls a global trade war? It feels totally counterintuitive.
Well, this really speaks to the resilience of global supply chains, doesn't it? And maybe the limits of tariffs to immediately reshape deeply embedded trade patterns.
So why the rally then?
Maersk's rally, according to the source, is mainly attributed to resilient global transport demand coming from outside the U.S.
Ah, okay. Not U.S.-centric.
Right. And their CEO, Vincent Clerc, he argued pretty strongly that tariffs, while disruptive, won't fundamentally stop global trade. Why? Because many products are just impossible or very difficult to substitute with local alternatives.
He gave the example of sneakers. Yeah.
Exactly. Like sneakers. Most of the world's athletic shoes are still made in just a few places. Mm. China, Vietnam, Indonesia.
You can't just suddenly start making millions of Nikes in, I don't know, Nebraska?
Not overnight, no. It would take years. Massive investment, re-engineering entire infrastructures. So even with tariffs making things more expensive, the goods still have to move across borders because there just aren't viable domestic alternatives yet.
It really highlights how deep these global supply chains run, built over decades for efficiency. They don't just unravel instantly.
Precisely. The trade war is still in its infancy, as the source notes, so the long-term impacts are still unfolding. But Maersk's performance suggests the immediate hit to global logistics might be less severe than some thought, especially if global demand outside the tariff zone stays strong.
It's a testament to the inertia, the interconnectedness of the global economy.
Definitely.
And for a more anecdotal, but maybe equally powerful insight, we heard about Joe Weisenthal and Tracy Alloway's interview with Dave Cavett. He's the CEO of Furniture Enterprises of Alaska.
Ah, yes, the Alaskan perspective. That was really revealing.
He painted a picture of just a logistical nightmare, didn't he? Showing how these big policies hit small businesses on the ground.
Yeah, his experience in Alaska, it shows the state already faces huge inherent supply chain problems, a much higher cost of living just because of its isolation.
Right. Almost everything has to be imported.
Exactly. Longer lead times, extra transport costs. It's just baked in due to the geography. So these new tariffs from the Trump administration, they don't just add a new cost layer.
They compound the existing problem.
Dramatically. They compound those existing logistical challenges.
So it's not just the tariff cost itself, but how it messes with an already fragile, complex system. For businesses like his, it means even more lead time, more transport costs.
And that directly hits local businesses and, ultimately, consumer prices in an already high-cost, isolated region. It's a powerful micro-level illustration of a macro-level policy decision.
Showing how decisions in Washington echo out to the most remote corners.
It underscores that the theoretical impacts of tariffs often show up in very practical, often painful ways for businesses and consumers locally, especially in places where supply chains are already stretched thin.
Makes sense. Okay, shifting focus slightly, let's talk Switzerland. Known for economic stability, precision, neutrality.
Right.
A Bloomberg survey suggests their economy is surprisingly resilient enough to largely shake off the initial shock of these U.S. tariffs over the next year.
Which is quite remarkable, especially when you consider they got hit with a 39% tariff rate.
39%, that's the highest in the developed world right now.
It is. But Switzerland isn't just sitting back. They're actively negotiating with the U.S., trying to get that levy reduced, maybe back down to 15%.
Still high, but better than 39.
Definitely. However, there's this looming threat of additional tariffs, particularly on pharmaceutical imports.
Ah, huge Swiss export sector.
Exactly. Pharma is a key industry, a huge source of their exports and intellectual property. So that threat remains a significant risk factor for their economy.
And if these high tariffs stick around long term, could that force the Swiss National Bank, the SNB, to do something drastic like negative interest rates?
It could really pressure them. They already cut borrowing costs to zero back in June. Negative rates would be a major or probably unwelcome step into unconventional monetary policy just to cushion the trade blow.
And the government's getting involved directly.
Very directly. They're planning talks with top execs from their pharma giants Roche and Novartis to discuss the whole situation.
Wow.
This level of direct engagement really underscores how critical this is for them, and it raises a really important question for us, doesn't it?
Which is?
How far will a government go? What unconventional measures will it consider to protect its key industries from external economic pressures, especially from a major trading partner?
That's a profound question. Are we seeing Switzerland, known for its free market approach, leaning more into industrial policy to defend itself?
That's precisely the tension here. Traditionally, they've relied on open markets, quality, innovation, but facing such a high tariff from the U.S., they're forced to explore all options.
Right.
This push for direct talks with pharma considering negative rates, it suggests a potential shift towards more active state intervention to safeguard strategic sectors.
And if more countries start doing this,
yeah,
adopting aggressive defense mechanisms against tariffs,
we could see a global landscape where national economic security, maybe protectionism, increasingly overrides pure free market principles, potentially leading to a more fragmented, maybe less efficient global economy. It's a calculated risk, but one they might feel they have to take.
A very different world order potentially emerging. Okay, let's transition now to geopolitics. Fault lines, regional tensions. Mm. They continue to shape global events, often with direct economic consequences.
And the Ukraine war remains absolutely central. High-stakes diplomatic efforts are clearly underway now.
We're looking at a Trump-Putin summit, scheduled for Alaska this Friday, highly anticipated, aimed at brokering some kind of agreement to end the war.
Yeah, huge global attention on this. And one of the most sensitive points, highlighted by NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, is the idea that Ukrainian territory will have to be on the table for talks.
That's a huge statement.
It is, but Rutte made a crucial distinction between factual recognition, basically, acknowledging Russia's de facto control on the ground, the reality, and political de jure recognition, which would be a formal legal cession of sovereignty, permanently giving up those lands.
A subtle but profoundly important difference in diplomacy. Huge implication.
Massive.
Right.
But Ukrainian President Zelensky, he continues to reject ceding any territory, citing international law, saying all temporarily occupied territories belong to Ukraine.
So a clear, almost irreconcilable difference right from the start makes a negotiated settlement incredibly difficult.
Indeed. And compounding that challenge, reports suggest U.S. and Russian officials are working towards a deal that would essentially lock in Moscow's occupation along current battle lines.
Like in Kherson and Zaporizhia.
Sources mention those areas specifically, yes. Areas Russia has largely controlled since early on. This proposed deal would basically formalize that de facto control Rutte mentioned, granting Russia permanent gains from its invasion.
And European leaders must be watching this with serious concern.
Oh, absolutely. They're reportedly conducting frenetic rounds of virtual meetings, trying to hammer out a unified strategy before the summit.
To avoid Ukraine getting pressured into accepting major land losses.
Exactly. They want to ensure Ukraine isn't sidelined or forced into a deal that undermines its sovereignty and, frankly, the principles of international law. It's a real race against time for them.
But what's fascinating and deeply unsettling is the continued military escalation, even as these peace talks loom. Ukraine claims successful drone strikes on major Russian oil facilities, Saratov, Lukoil refineries.
Right. While Russia reports intercepting lots of Ukrainian drones and projectiles.
And simultaneously, Ukraine reports Russian strikes on its own energy infrastructure, an oil depot, a gas compressor station, plus residential buildings in Zaporizhia.
It just underscores the deep-seated, brutal nature of this conflict, doesn't it? Even with diplomacy happening, neither side is letting up on the battlefield.
The oil markets certainly reacted to the diplomatic angle, though. Brent crude fell, biggest weekly drop since June.
Partly on that renewed hope for a peace deal, maybe an end to sanctions on Russian oil supply.
Which could, ironically, worsen a forecasted global oil glut and drive prices down further.
It just shows how intricately linked geopolitics and global markets are, even anticipating potential outcomes.
Okay, moving to another persistent global conflict, Israel and Gaza. Prime Minister Netanyahu is defending his plan for a military sweep against what he calls the final Hamas strongholds in Gaza City.
Right. Framing the goal is freeing Gaza from Hamas and, crucially, recovering the hostages still believed to be alive, around 20 or so.
But his plan faces opposition.
Significant opposition. Both within Israel, polls show a majority there prefer a negotiated deal for hostages over a full offensive and internationally.
And the humanitarian situation. Netanyahu says aid is getting through, denies claims of deliberate starvation.
But that starkly contrasts with the UN's World Food Program. They say a quarter of Gazans are on the brink of famine, and aid truck numbers are way below the 600 daily needed, a deeply concerning gap between statements and reality on the ground.
And diplomatically, we saw a significant shift. Australia announced it will formally recognize a Palestinian state at the UN summit in September.
Yeah, that's a notable break from its close ally, the US, which usually wants a negotiated settlement before recognition.
And New Zealand is considering it, too.
Also considering recognition, with a decision expected in September, they join the UK, France, Canada in this move.
Arguing a two-state solution is humanity's best hope.
Pretty much. And emphasizing the situation has gone beyond the world's worst fears, implying urgent action is needed, it shows a growing international consensus, or at least more nations acting independently of the US on this.
How did Netanyahu respond to Australia's plan?
Sharply. Called it shameful. Said Israel will win with or without the support of others. He even made a provocative comparison to hypothetical attacks on Australian cities.
Wow, really highlighting the deep divisions and maybe the lack of appetite for compromise despite international pressure.
It really reveals the intractable nature of the conflict from the Israeli perspective. Their commitment to perceived security needs, regardless of shifting global opinion, makes the path to a two-state solution, even with more recognition, incredibly challenging.
Okay, beyond those major conflicts, other significant diplomatic developments are happening in Iran.
Iran stated emphatically they will not allow nuclear site inspections when a senior IAEA official visits Tehran. Foreign Minister Arachi said no cooperation will begin until a new agreement framework is reached.
That's a hardening stance.
Yeah.
What does it mean for non-proliferation efforts?
It's significant. It raises important questions about nuclear transparency. Iran seems to be using inspections as a bargaining chip for a broader new deal that suits its interests better.
Which could increase international tensions.
Absolutely. Especially given ongoing concerns about their nuclear program and regional influence puts the IAEA in a really tough spot. Their monitoring depends on cooperation.
Then there's Colombia, facing fraying relations with the U.S.
Yes. Rosa Villavicencio is set to be confirmed as foreign minister amidst complex issues, migration, security policy disagreements, and an unprecedented surge in cocaine production straining ties, plus tensions with Peru over airspace and an island.
And the stakes are high.
Incredibly high. The Trump administration decides next month whether to recertify Colombia as an ally in the drug war. Decertification would be a massive blow, potentially limiting access to crucial U.S. aid and international loans.
It shows how domestic issues, like drug production, can quickly become major international diplomatic problems with huge financial consequences.
Undermining long-standing alliances, even. A vivid example.
And finally, the South China Sea. Still tense.
Tensions escalating, it seems. The Philippines reported a Chinese ship used a water cannon against one of its vessels near a disputed shoal.
An aggressive act.
Definitely. And it comes right after Philippine President Marcos Jr.'s strong remarks over Taiwan, which is obviously highly sensitive for Beijing.
So China asserting its claims, using aggressive but non-lethal means.
Seems like it. A clear signal of rising friction in one of the world's most vital waterways. It impacts not just the countries involved, but global trade routes, regional stability, keeps everyone on edge.
All right, let's pivot now to the dynamic shifts in global markets and economic trends. Always interesting to see where the money is flowing or not flowing. We have a quick snapshot for you from the close of markets on August 11, 2025.
Okay, let's see the numbers.
Equities were mixed globally. Stocks, you're up 600, pretty much unchanged. U.S. futures, S&P 500, NASDAQ 100, Dow Jones, also a little changed. Suggests a cautious start to the week there.
Any movement in Asia or emerging markets?
Slight gains. MSCI Asia Pacific Index up 0.3%. MSCI Emerging Markets Index gained 0.2%. Some appetite for risk there, perhaps?
Okay, currencies.
The Bloomberg Dollar Spot Index was little changed, so relative stability for the dollar.
Yeah.
Euro, offshore yuan, British pound, also stable against the dollar. The yen did edge up 0.2%.
And the cryptos, you mentioned unexpected movements earlier.
Yeah, they continued their climb. Bitcoin up 2.7% to 121,607 sellers. Ether rose 1.3% to $4,272.94. Still some eye-popping numbers there.
Definitely eye-popping. Fixed income.
Yield on 10-year treasuries down 3 basis points to 4.26%. Suggests maybe a slight flight to safety or anticipation of rate cuts. German and British 10-year yields also fell.
And commodities.
Brent crude fell 0.9% to $65.96. Maybe that geopolitical optimism we talked about. Spot gold dropped 1.1% to $3,359.80 an ounce. But interestingly, lithium prices saw a significant spike.
Ah, yes, the lithium story. We need to dig into that. Hints at underlying supply issues.
We will definitely circle back to that. Okay, now let's talk more about that cryptocurrency boom we just saw in the snapshot. Bitcoin nearing its all-time high, over $122,000. Not far off the mid-July record.
And Ether surging, too, above $4,300. Highest since, what, December 2021.
That's right. So what's driving these impressive gains? Is it just retail hype again, or is there something more substantial this time?
Well, it's definitely something more substantial, although retail hype always plays a part, you know?
Sure.
But these gains are largely attributed to mounting interest and, importantly, direct inflows from large institutional investors and corporate treasury buyers, too.
Ah, the big money.
Exactly. We're seeing these dedicated digital asset treasury companies, basically listed firms that strategically pile up crypto on their balance sheets. They've amassed a staggering Bitcoin stockpile worth $113
billion. $113
billion. And Ether worth some $13 billion. This institutional validation, the sheer volume of capital flowing in from major players, that's a key driver. It's a fundamental shift in the market's structure.
So it's not just individuals anymore. Big money is truly in crypto now. And analysts are highlighting Bitcoin's growing traction as a borderless, tariff-free store of value.
Yeah, that narrative is getting stronger.
Especially, they argue, as traditional safe havens like gold face supply bottlenecks and policy risk from these new U.S. tariffs we discussed earlier, Bitcoin seems to be gaining an edge there.
That's a critical point. It reflects a shift in how investors perceive value. In a world fragmented by trade policies, tariffs, Bitcoin's decentralized global nature makes it uniquely attractive as a store of value.
Right. It's not subject to export bans or import duties in the same way.
Exactly. Or geopolitical whims like physical commodities or even traditional financial instruments can be. It makes it an appealing alternative, particularly when gold is facing new frictions. It's a compelling argument for a certain segment of investors.
And speaking of retail frenzy, we have this fascinating story from South Korea, always a crypto hotspot. Bitmine Immersion Technologies, a U.S.-listed Bitcoin miner that actually pivoted its whole business model to become a digital asset treasury.
Right. They now hold the largest Ether treasury globally, $3.6 billion worth.
Incredible pivot. And they've become the top foreign equity pick among South Korean retail investors.
It truly showcases the intense speculative fervor over there. South Korea has about 18 million active digital asset market participants.
18 million.
And they poured a net $259 million into Bitmine shares just since July. Shows an almost insatiable appetite for crypto exposure, even indirectly through a treasury company.
But it was volatile, right?
Extremely. This is also a stark reminder of the inherent volatility. Bitmine shares surged over 3,000%.
3,000%.
Before plunging 62%. Very short period. High risk, high reward is definitely in play. Many retail investors could face significant losses if they get caught on the wrong side of these wild swings.
It's incredible enthusiasm, but that volatility is a serious warning.
Yeah.
Are there safeguards for these retail investors, or is it buyer beware?
That's a crucial question. Unfortunately, regulation often lags behind innovation in these fast-moving markets. South Korea has an active market, but regulations often focus on curbing illicit activity or scams, not necessarily insulating investors from pure volatility.
Mm.
And these treasury companies often exist in a bit of a gray area, not regulated like traditional banks. So for the most part, especially with highly speculative plays like Bitmine, it largely remains buyer beware. the onus is on the individual to understand the extreme risks.
A risky game. Okay, let's shift gears to central bank posture and bond market dynamics. Ovid gives us clues about the broader economy. The European Central Bank, the ECB, they're expected to wait until December for their next rate cut.
Yeah, and that's likely to be the final move in the current cycle, according to the sources.
Why the delay?
Well, this timing gives policymakers more crucial time. Time to assess the lingering impact of President Trump's trade disruptions on the Eurozone. Time to get a clearer picture of Q3 economic performance and their updated 2028 projections.
So a cautious, data-dependent approach.
Very much so. They want to understand the full ramifications of external shocks before committing to more big policy shifts.
Okay. Now, on a different note, the Bank of Spain, its chief, José Luis Escrivá, seems to be in the middle of a political storm.
Yeah, quite a bit of turmoil there. High-profile exits, four director generals, the chief economist.
The chief economist reportedly resigned after being told to revise a report.
That's what the source indicates, yes. And Escrivá himself is accused of an aggressive tone, micromanagement, and critically muzzling technocratic critiques of government policy. That's serious stuff for a central bank.
It's an immense amount of turmoil. And it directly challenges the idea of central bank independence, doesn't it?
Absolutely. A government commission review actually identified an excessive concentration of power in the governor's hands and recommended a revamp of management structures.
So this whole situation raises a huge question, right, about the independence of central banks. How independent can they really be when political pressure is increasing?
And what are the implications when a central bank's ability to provide objective analysis is openly questioned, potentially compromised? It's a critical issue.
Because if the Bank of Spain is seen bending to political will, what does that do to market trust, domestically, internationally? Does it erode confidence in their data, their forecasts, their decisions?
It absolutely can. Central bank independence is usually seen as sacrosanct for stability and trust. If policymakers or the public think decisions are influenced by politics, not just economics, credibility can be lost.
Leading to volatility, difficulty managing inflation expectations.
Potentially, yes. Less effective monetary policy overall. The situation in Spain is a stark reminder that the line between political oversight and undue interference can be very fine, even in established democracies. Crossing it can have serious repercussions.
A concerning precedent. Okay, turning to India. Lakshmi Iyer at Bajaj Finserv sees India's long-tenor sovereign bonds as a buying opportunity.
Yeah, that's a notable call, especially now. She attributes it to the wide yield spread over 100 basis points between 30-year and 5-year government debt.
And who's buying?
She notes significant demand from big institutional players, pension funds, insurers. They're long-term investors looking for stable, higher yields to match their liabilities.
So they see it as a good entry point, even though the Reserve Bank of India is holding rates steady because of inflation risks.
Exactly. It reflects a calculated bet on India's long-term economic prospects and its bond market. Seeking yield in what's otherwise a cautious global environment shows underlying confidence in India's fiscal stability over the long haul.
And speaking of turnarounds, European peripheral bonds, Italy, Spain, Ireland, Portugal, Greece, they were bond pariahs a decade and a half ago during the debt crisis.
Right. High risk, potential default.
But now they've transformed into top picks for fixed income firms. That's a remarkable redemption story.
It truly is a significant turnaround, reflecting a profound reevaluation of risk and opportunity in the Eurozone debt market.
So they're seen as healthy alternatives now to safer bets like Germany and France.
Pretty much. Driven by two key things. First, a stronger post-pandemic economic recovery in the periphery than maybe expected. And second, Germany's strategic decision to abandon fiscal austerity.
Ah, that's a big shift for Germany.
Huge. No. And it's expected to lead to a deluge of new German bonds hitting the market, which could depress the prices and yields, making the relatively higher yields of the peripheral bonds even more appealing by comparison.
Makes sense. Finally, carry trades are ramping up in emerging markets. Remind us what a carry trade is again.
Sure. Basically, investors borrow money in a currency with a low interest rate. Think Japanese yen, for example. Then they use that borrowed money to buy assets or invest in currencies that offer a higher interest rate, like in many emerging markets. They hope to profit from that interest rate difference.
And that strategy is making a comeback now.
A big comeback in emerging markets, yes. Fueled by two main things. First, growing expectations of Fed rate cuts, which would typically weaken the U.S. dollar.
And making it cheaper to borrow in dollars.
Or just making other currencies relatively more attractive. Second, there's a renewed appetite among investors for those higher-yielding currencies in places like Brazil, South Africa, Egypt, where central banks kept rates higher to fight inflation.
And volatility plays a role.
Yes. What's particularly appealing now is that emerging market currencies are showing less volatility compared to their G10 peers. That makes the carry strategy, which is sensitive to currency swings, more attractive, suggests renewed confidence in the relative stability of key emerging markets.
Interesting dynamic. Okay, now for a more sobering note, highlighting a significant vulnerability. Private credit losses and Germany's growing property bust.
Yeah, this is a worrying trend. The article highlights Germany's biggest property crash since the 2008 crisis is starting to reveal tens of millions in write-downs.
And hitting smaller players,
yeah,
like pension funds, insurers.
Exactly. These groups often ended up taking on the riskiest parts of complex, multi-layered financing deals. They were chasing yield in that low interest rate environment we had for so long.
And the article gave a specific example, right? The Canyon Project in Frankfurt.
Yes, a striking, almost absurd case study, meant to be a trailblazing office development instead. It resulted in significant write-downs for two small pension funds for dentists and pharmacists, specifically who helped finance it.
And now all it's there is.
Quite literally, a pile of sand with a pop-up beach club, a powerful, darkly humorous image for a failed investment.
A financial satire come to life. But beyond the dark humor, what went wrong? Just optimistic valuations or something more flawed in the financing?
It was a mix. The market was definitely built on incredibly optimistic valuations and demand projections that just didn't pan out, especially with changing work habits.
Right, post-pandemic shifts.
Critically, these smaller, less sophisticated investors, desperate for yield, relied heavily on external advisors who maybe didn't fully explain the risks. And this reflects a broader systemic shift, doesn't it? Risk moving from regulated bank balance sheets to less transparent parts of the financial ecosystem.
Where oversight might be weaker.
And expertise might be less robust. These smaller funds just don't have the deep analysis capabilities of major banks.
And the debt structures themselves were complicated. Using Schuldschein debt.
Yes. That's a specific type of German promissory note. Almost like a direct loan between investor and company, but crucially, not publicly traded. So it often avoids some stricter regulatory oversight compared to bank loans or bonds.
And this allowed institutional investors to lend directly to development projects, often sidestepping banking licenses.
Exactly. Which led to projects with dozens, sometimes hundreds, of creditors, many lacking real estate expertise.
Making restructurings a nightmare when things go south.
Absolutely. Project First in Berlin, another failure, had 130 creditors trying to negotiate simultaneously. Imagine that.
Chaos.
Experts warn the final bill will come in 2 or 3 years because many of these deals are being kept alive by new money right now, kicking the can down the road.
Which raises a really important question. What are the long-term systemic implications of these poorly structured, high-risk private credit deals becoming widespread? Hidden from traditional bank scrutiny. Could this be the next big shoe to drop?
That's the chilling thought, isn't it? If the risk moved out of regulated banks into these less transparent private credit markets, does it just create a new, potentially larger systemic vulnerability?
And what triggers the end? When does the new money lifeline stop?
That's the key. The trigger could be a sustained period of higher interest rates, making new financing too expensive, or a sharper than expected economic downturn hitting property values even harder.
And if those lifelines dry up,
then the true scale of defaults and write-downs becomes apparent, potentially impacting the broader system as pension funds, insurers have to liquidate assets or pass losses on. The systemic risk lies in the interconnectedness of these less visible markets and the potential for a cascade if too many deals unravel at once, making orderly restructuring incredibly hard.
A quiet but significant storm brewing. Definitely something to watch. Okay, let's transition to technology, industry shifts, and broader societal commentary. Always a fascinating mix.
Right. In the tech sector, Palantir Technologies, what a meteoric rise.
Shares up nearly 2,500% since its 2020 debut. Almost 150% this year alone.
Incredible numbers, driven largely by its growing use of AI and its deep, long-standing ties to government contracts, especially defense and intelligence.
But the valuation is causing a headache for analysts.
A real headache. It trades at an eye-wateringly expensive 245 times forward earnings.
245 times. compared to NVIDIA at?
So around 35 times forward earnings. And NVIDIA itself is considered richly valued. That vast difference really highlights the speculative premium on Palantir.
So how are bulls justifying it?
They're scrambling to justify it, the source says, relying on audacious growth goals like 50% annual growth for the next 5 years.
Wow, that's ambitious.
Very. Meanwhile, Wall Street analysts show significant unease, more hold or sell ratings than buys, skepticism about its sustainability.
It sounds like that classic must-own paradox we've seen before in tech.
Exactly. Despite valuation concerns, analysts' worries. It's become a stock many portfolio managers feel they have to own just to beat benchmarks, especially AI-focused ones.
Reminds me of Netflix back in the day, trading it over 280 times forward earnings at its peak before normalizing.
It's a great comparison. Highlights the speculative nature that can accompany transformative tech like AI. The big question is whether Palantir's underlying business, especially its expansion into commercial sectors, will eventually catch up to the valuation, or if it faces a similar normalization. High risk, high reward.
Definitely. Now, shifting to a really interesting AI development speaks to its global adaptability. A Malaysian company, Xetrinx AI, unveiled new AI.
Ah, yes, the AI large language model specifically designed for Muslims.
Leveraging open source AI from China's DeepSeek, an interesting cross-cultural tech collaboration.
Truly innovative, a significant step towards culturally tailored AI. Nur AI aims to serve a huge market, some 2 billion people globally.
Offering guidance on what? Dining, legal advice, lifestyle?
All of that. Health, financial services, all based on Sharia or Islamic values. In multiple languages, Malay, Indonesian, Arabic, English.
And future plans include AI avatars of Islamic scholars. Ambitious.
Very ambitious. The model itself uses DeepSeek's mixture of experts architecture, which basically uses multiple smaller specialized networks, allows for faster results, reduced computational costs compared to one giant model built under the ASEAN China AI Lab initiative.
What's fascinating is the emergence of these culturally tailored AI solutions, challenging the Western and Chinese-centric models.
Absolutely. It positions new AI as a distinct alternative, plans for global expansion, customized with local data, cultural nuances. It's even working to automate admin functions in Malaysia's Sharia-based courts. Shows the depth of its intended use.
This isn't just a niche tech thing, is it?
Yeah.
It has geopolitical implications for AI development, adoption, cultural influence globally.
It absolutely does. Developing AI tailored to specific cultural or religious framework through cross-national collaborations, it could reshape the global AI landscape.
Yeah.
Challenge U.S. and Chinese dominance.
Raises questions about data sovereignty, cultural sensitivity in AI.
And the potential for a more fragmented but maybe more diverse AI ecosystem could lead to AI that's more effective for specific communities, but also raises new discussions about how AI's values get encoded.
Very interesting. Okay, staying with data, but infrastructure side. Pacific Equity Partners is nearing a deal to acquire a majority stake in Spark New Zealand's data center business.
Yes, valuing the assets at over NZ$600 million, about $357 million US.
And this follows other big data center deals in the region.
It does. A clear trend. Driven by the explosive boom in machine learning, AI development, cloud tech demand, the underlying infrastructure for AI and cloud is just a hot commodity. Investors are pouring capital into these essential assets. They're the backbone of the digital economy.
Makes sense. Okay, let's move into energy transition and supply chain dynamics. Lots of turbulence and transformation here. The global lithium market, for instance, just saw a major shakeup.
Yeah, the CATL mine suspension in China, Contemporary Amperex Technology Co., LTD.
They abruptly suspended production at their major Jiangxi lithium mine in Jiangxi province. For at least 3 months, mining license expired.
And this one mine accounts for about 6% of global output, with another 5% coming from other mines in the same region facing potential similar issues.
So the market reaction?
Immediate spike in lithium prices. Futures on the Guangzhou exchange hit their daily limit, rose as much as allowed in one day. Spot prices rose 3% to their highest since February.
And shares of lithium producers surged. Tianqi, Ganfeng, Australian miners.
All surged. Pilbara Minerals, Liontown, Mineral Resources highlights the extreme sensitivity to supply disruptions for critical materials like lithium, essential for the energy transition.
And this spurs speculation that Beijing is actively tackling overcapacity, part of its anti-involution campaign.
Exactly. Anti-involution here means China trying to move away from intense, low-profit competition and overproduction. aiming for higher quality, more sustainable growth. So, ironically, this supply pause is seen as a boon for an industry plagued by a glut and low prices for over 2 years.
An unusual way to bring market-balanced government intervention.
It is. Shows how policy in a major producer like China can directly, immediately impact global commodity markets. Not just tariffs, but direct regulation. A powerful lever Beijing is willing to pull to reshape strategic industries.
Okay, now to Indonesia. Signaling a later start for boosting mandatory biodiesel blending from 40% to 50%.
Yeah, now looking at sometime later in 2026, not January as previously thought.
Why the delay?
Practical reasons. Safety tests, essential for higher blends, take 6 to 8 months. They haven't even been scheduled yet.
But Indonesia's ambition is still there, using palm oil for biofuel to cut import dependence.
The ambition is there, yes. Enhance energy security, use domestic palm oil. But challenges remain. Palm oil production has stagnated. The current B40 program already reduced exports by 7%. Ramping up to B50 needs significant extra domestic capacity, which is proving hard to secure, hence the delay.
Okay, and maybe one of the most surprising insights today, the global EV transition, happening faster than you think.
Yeah, and developing nations are surging ahead in adoption. Cars, two-wheelers, contrary to the narrative that it's just a rich world thing.
Really? Who's leading besides China?
Well, China leads globally, near half market share for plug-ins. But look at Vietnam, largely thanks to VinFast, over a third of car sales are EVs. Turkey, 13% EV share. Indonesia, 7.4%. Malaysia, 8.6%. These are close to or even matching developed market adoption rates, a dramatic shift.
Wow. What are the key drivers for this faster adoption in the global south, especially with lower incomes?
Several practical factors. Battery cars are nearing or hitting price parity with conventional cars there. Falling battery costs help, plus a weaker U.S. dollar improves purchasing power for components.
And running costs.
Lower ownership costs are huge. Electricity is often cheaper than gas, less maintenance. Especially impactful for commercial transport taxis, ride hailing. Savings add up quickly.
In government policy.
Policymakers are extending incentives. EVs help cut massive oil and gas import bills up to a third of total imports for India-Pakistan. Improves their current count deficits.
What's striking, almost ironic, is the article's critique of the developed world here, suggesting rich countries are sabotaging their own transition plans.
Yeah, through new tariffs, bungled charger rollouts, loosened fuel economy rules. It sounds like they're letting incumbent car makers prolong obsolete businesses.
While the global south seizes the tech lead.
That's the argument. It raises that important question. Will developed nations ultimately pay a higher price for their slower EV transition?
Could leave them lagging significantly.
The article strongly suggests their protectionism, fragmented infrastructure, reluctance to fully embrace the shift could do just that. Meanwhile, emerging markets leapfrog older tech, gain a competitive edge, a compelling argument that short-sighted policies could lead to long-term disadvantage.
Food for thought. Okay, let's touch on some other industry and economic developments. Singapore's logistics startup, Ninjavan.
Right. A big player in Southeast Asia e-commerce. They're in talks to raise an internal funding round, but it would slash their valuation by about half, down to roughly $1 billion.
Ouch. A sign of the funding winter.
The latest sign, the source says, of tech companies struggling in Southeast Asia. Marked by job cuts, CEO resignations, falling valuations amidst global uncertainties, tighter venture capital.
And regional peers like Grab, GoTo, have struggled too.
Underperformed in public markets, yes. Struggling to balance growth and profitability in a super competitive logistics industry with thin margins. Tough environment for growth startups.
In Germany, the grid regulator is investigating potential gas market manipulation. Around $60 million in extra costs.
Yes, between mid-May and mid-July 2025. Involves a discrepancy with fuel needed to convert gas between different qualities, L gas from Netherlands versus H gas from Norway, Russia.
And this could hit consumers.
Potentially. The regulator warned this might mean raising a levy that finances gas conversion. That levy usually gets passed straight to consumers via higher gas prices. Bad timing as the government tries to lower energy bills. Shows vulnerabilities in energy markets impacting household costs.
And China's mega dam project in Tibet, facing strict scrutiny for green financing.
Yes, the 1.2 trillion yuan project on the Yarlung Tsangpo River. Significant scrutiny due to potential environmental and social impacts.
Why the concern?
Large hydropower projects often raise flags. This one overlaps a key biodiversity hotspot, could displace residents, impact millions downstream in India, Bangladesh.
Even though China leads in issuing green debt.
Exactly. They issued $84.5 billion this year, most globally. But the scrutiny here emphasizes growing importance of genuine ESG, environmental, social governance, beyond just the green label, investors, regulators looking at actual impact.
Finally, this really interesting piece about the economy being ripe for fakes and copycat luxury goods, it distinguished between fakes and dupes.
Yeah, a key distinction. Fakes are outright counterfeits, illegal logos, often fund organized crime. Dupes are similar, cheaper versions mimicking the style, not pretending to be the real thing.
And we're seeing super fakes now, almost indistinguishable.
Yes. Escalating costs of genuine luxury goods let illicit makers invest more in production quality, makes counterfeits incredibly hard to spot.
And dupe culture is being legitimized by TikTok influencers.
Explicitly, they openly recommend cheaper alternatives, making it mainstream, socially acceptable. Creates a huge challenge for luxury brands. Protect IP without alienating consumers seeking affordable style. Lululemon suing Costco over design features is an example of brands pushing back.
So how do brands stay resilient?
Brand integrity is crucial. Hermès Birkin bag remains coveted despite dupes, partly due to its handmade nature, scarcity, reputation. Highlights that supply chain integrity, how it's made, and consumer perception of genuine value are key in fighting fakes.
And recent scandals might make consumers question what they're paying for.
Exactly. Scandals at Loro Piana or Dior encourage consumers to ask, "What am I really getting for this price?" Increased scrutiny could ironically push brands to ensure their products really deliver on quality, ethics, uniqueness. An unexpected silver lining, maybe.
Wow, what a journey through the global landscape today. Finance, politics, technology.
It really covered a lot of ground.
From tariffs hitting your wallet, the wild ride of crypto, to quiet battles over voting rights and surprising protest symbols, we've really seen how interconnected everything is.
Absolutely. Events in one corner ripple across industries, influence personal finances.
So if we connect this all to the bigger picture.
It's clear the global economic and political systems are being reshaped by powerful, often conflicting forces, nationalistic trade policies, geopolitical shifts, tech disruptions, changing social values.
Right.
The insights today highlight not just the challenges, but also the remarkable resilience, adaptability, even creativity we're seeing across the board, from corporations to central banks to grassroots movements.
So, reflecting on all that,
Yeah.
what's one big takeaway or question that really sticks with you? Something for our listeners to mull over.
That's a good question. I think given this intricate web of events, the specific challenges and opportunities facing different nations and industries, it raises an important question for you, our listener. What area do you think will see the most surprising transformation in the next year, and why? Maybe it's a technology we didn't fully explore, a geopolitical flashpoint that suddenly changes, or an economic trend that quietly grows into something huge. What's your prediction? Where will the biggest surprise come from?
That is a fantastic thought to leave us with. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We hope you feel a little more informed, definitely a little more curious, and ready to explore these topics further on your own.
Always more to learn.
Absolutely. Until next time, keep digging into the knowledge.